Good afternoon. My name is Sarah Teich. I'm the president of the Student Legal Forum and a member of last year's Virginia Law Review Managing Board. On behalf of both organizations, I want to welcome all of you here today and thank you for coming to this year's annual Ola B. Smith Lecture. We are extremely pleased to have Judge William Fletcher of the Ninth Circuit here with us today. Before we get started, I want to quickly thank a couple of people. I'd like to thank Andy Gens, Rachel Sella, and Porter Wilkinson of the Student Legal Forum, Kendra Robbins, Jim Zucker, Nora Cooney, and Leslie Kendrick of the Virginia Law Review. Following Judge Fletcher's remarks, we'll have time for a couple of questions, and then we would invite all of you to join us for a brief reception in Judge Fletcher's honor. Thanks again for attending, and Dean John Jeffries.
Thank you. I horned my way into this event so that I would have a chance to say a couple of words. It's a fertile time of year here, Willie. William A. Fletcher was sworn in on the Ninth Circuit on February 12, 1999. Since that time, he has served with all the grace, good humor, intellectual distinction, and soundness of judgment that anyone who knew him would have predicted. Before then, Willie was a law professor at the University of California, Berkeley, and it won't surprise you that I know him much better as an academic than as a judge. He joined that faculty in 1977, immediately after clerking for Justice Brennan, taught there for 22 years, and to the great pleasure and gratitude of Berkeley students, continues to teach part-time. He writes in areas that I try to know something about, federal courts and civil procedure. He's a co-author of a civil procedure casebook that some of you may have used, and a principal, perhaps the principal proponent of what has come to be called the diversity interpretation of the 11th Amendment, which all of you do or should know. Willie's scholarship in these and other topics is well known to everyone in the field. It's characterized by a deeply nuanced historical understanding and by great clarity, both of reasoning and of expression. His article on standing, The Structure of Standing, published in the Yale Law Journal in 1988, is simply the best thing ever written on that subject. I commend it to your attention. It sits atop a veritable mountain of lesser publications and puts all of them to rest. Judge Fletcher is also, and perhaps to his regret, single-handedly responsible for one of the oddest provisions in the United States Code. When he was nominated to the Ninth Circuit by his law school classmate, President Clinton, in 1995, his fitness for the position was just beyond question. A manifestly talented academic, gifted advocate, Rhodes Scholar, former Supreme Court law clerk, just coincidentally co-chair of President Clinton's election campaign committee in California. Republicans, however, did find reason to object, and the reason they found was that when he was appointed to the Ninth Circuit, he would join his mother, Judge Betty Fletcher, who'd been appointed to the Ninth Circuit by President Carter. And they claimed that the appointment of the son to a court on which the mother sat violated an anti-nepotism statute. Now, there is such a statute, although it, to a plain old ordinary lawyer like me, quite clearly speaks to hiring court officials, employees, and forbids courts from hiring officials who are relatives of the judges who sit in those courts. It doesn't apply to appointment of judges who are relatives of judges, and the Office of Legal Counsel so found after careful study. Nonetheless, Willie was not confirmed, and in 1996, the Republican Senate in what was, I don't know whether that was the first round or the eighth round in the escalating disputes about confirmations of judicial appointees, but the Republicans in 1996 shut down confirmation of circuit court nominations and simply refused to go forward in the as it turned out, vain hope that they would win the presidency. That did not happen. As you know, President Clinton was reelected, and he renominated Willie Fletcher, and the nomination again stalled, again on the ground that the excessive influence that Betty Fletcher would exercise over her son was corrupting. So after many more steps than are worth describing to you here, a deal was reached. Judge Willie Fletcher would be confirmed. Judge Betty Fletcher would take senior status. That meant that they would never sit on bonk together and cast votes in the same case. And here's the kicker. And President Clinton would nominate to succeed Judge Betty Fletcher a Republican suggestion, a woman named Barbara Durham, who was the favorite of Republican Senator Slade Corton of Washington. And that's what happened, although, as I understand it, Ms. Durham subsequently withdrew her nomination. Now, at this point, everything's worked out in classic Washingtonian, you know, this is how they make sausage, you don't really want to see it, way. So at this point, one would think everybody's happy, the judge is confirmed at long last, 3 years and some months and counting. The Republicans have gotten a seat on the Ninth Circuit, extracted from the Democratic president. Judge Betty Fletcher is no doubt filled with maternal pride. Everything seems good. But having ballyhooed so much about this anti-nepotism statute, the Republicans now felt kind of morally obliged to carry through. So they amended the law so that it now provides that you cannot appoint as a judge anyone who is related by affinity or consanguinity within the degree of first cousin. I haven't taught family law in a long time, so I'm not even sure I understand what it means to be a first cousin by consanguinity. But anyway, you cannot appoint someone who is related by affinity or by consanguinity within the degree of first cousin to any judge who is a member of the same court. And now that the Republic has been secured against the threat of another learned and Augustus hand, we are at liberty to proceed. So we can now say, not just as a matter of talent and quality and personality, human grace, but as a matter of the statutory law of the United States, that there can never be another judge like Willie Fletcher.
Well, thank you very much, John. That's a much better introduction than I usually get, and a much better introduction than I deserve by far. First, let me begin by thanking you for the invitation to appear at this lecture. It's a great honor to have been invited. It is an even greater honor on a day like this to have so many people attending the lecture. And I will do my best to do honor to you and to the lecture by what I have to say today, and to the great law school that has sponsored the lecture. My topic is international human rights in the American courts. It's stimulated by the Supreme Court's recent decision in the case called Sosa versus Alvarez Machain, decided in 2004, which was in turn stimulated, at least in part, by two professors at this law school, Professors Bradley and Goldsmith, to whose work I will return in a moment. But let me begin at the beginning. While I've written out the talk, it's easier, I think, for you to hear it if I talk it. So I'll use my text really more than notes. I'll begin at the beginning. Immediately after the ratification of the Constitution, the first Congress got down to business in September of 1789 with a matter of urgent business. It passed the Judiciary Act of 1789, establishing a working federal judiciary. As part of that statute, it established the circuit courts. The circuit courts were given under Section 11 of that act jurisdiction over diversity cases. The Supreme Court justices, riding circuit, in fact, for the first decades of their existence, spent most of their time as trial judges riding circuit. In Section 9 of the statute, they created the district courts. Now, the district court judges had admiralty jurisdiction, a small criminal jurisdiction, and they had a jurisdiction over what has later come to be known as, well, it has various names, Alien Tort Claim Statute, Alien Tort Act, Alien Tort Statute. I'll follow the lead of the Supreme Court in the Sosa case and call it the Alien Tort Statute, now codified at 28 U.S.C. 1350. It read as follows, and it reads more or less the same today. Federal district courts shall have cognizance, concurrent with the courts of the several states or the circuit courts, as the case may be, of all causes where an alien sues for a tort only in violation of the law of nations or a treaty of the United States. Now, there are a number of interesting things about this statute. First off, it authorized jurisdiction in the district court rather than the circuit court, who were the primary federal trial courts, and it authorized jurisdiction without an amount in controversy requirement. Under Section 11, diversity cases had a $500 amount in controversy requirement, which in those days was truly enormous, ensuring that only the most important commercial litigation would show up in federal district court in diversity. Here we have going to the district courts, which means that the suit can be brought in a court with a full-time sitting judge, not a circuit judge who comes around from time to time, and can be brought without regard to amount in controversy. Both aspects designed to make it easier to bring that civil lawsuit. Second, the two sources of substantive right that were specified are of some interest. The two sources of substantive rights are, number one, torts in violation of the law of nations, and number two, violation of treaties. The second of the two is unproblematic jurisdictionally. The second, as I will discuss in a moment, was quite problematic. The second, that is to say, the provision allowing enforcement of treaties, that's easily understood as coming under the arising under jurisdiction of Article 3. For those of you who have not yet had federal courts, I'll give you a quick little federal courts course. Article 3 of the Federal Constitution, the judiciary article, has various heads of jurisdiction. Federal question jurisdiction, so-called, admiralty jurisdiction, diversity jurisdiction, and so on. The statutes then implement those heads of jurisdiction. The statutes don't have to be as broad as the Article III authorization, but they can be no broader. So unless you can find a source of jurisdiction in Article III, federal courts cannot take jurisdiction. With that as an introduction, then let's look at the jurisdiction of Section 1350, authorizing the federal courts to hear suits based upon the law of nations. The law of nations then, and only to a degree now, the law of nations then were not federal law. No one ever thought they were federal law at that time. They were simply the law of nations. If they came within a general category, they would have been called part of the general law, along with the law merchant or lots of other parts of the general law. So federal question was not available as a source of jurisdiction. It was thought at the time by many, including by Oliver Ellsworth, the first Chief Justice and the drafter of this part of the statute, that alienage jurisdiction at Article III was available all you needed was an alien. And it did not matter that you had a plaintiff alien and a defendant alien, or a plaintiff alien and a defendant citizen of another state. All that was required that there be an alien. In 1809, in a case called Hodgson versus Bower Bank, the Supreme Court set us straight, saying the alienage jurisdiction is available only when there's an alien on one side and a state on the other side, or a citizen of an American state on the other side. It is not available when there's an alien suing an alien. That meant from that time forward that statute was not available for suit between two aliens for violation of the law of nations because it was jurisdictionally insufficient. The statute I guess I should say one third thing about it. There's almost no reported litigation under that statute in the early years. One of the reasons, I think, is that there's a paucity of reported litigation, period, during that early period. Another reason, I think it is the restricted subject matter jurisdiction after the Supreme Court's decision in 1809, you were going to get no suits brought by an alien against another alien as soon as that was made clear by the Supreme Court. And then finally, there were other statutes that were available for certain litigation involving ambassadors and so on. But for whatever the complex set of reasons, the statute essentially disappeared. After this very brief moment in the sun, it finally reappears after an absence of almost 200 years. It reappears in 1980 in the Second Circuit in a case called Falardica versus Pena Irala. The survivors of a Paraguayan who had been tortured to death in Paraguay found the torturer in the United States. They served process on the torturer and brought suit in federal district court in the Eastern District of New York under the Alien Tort Statute, alleging a violation of the law of nations, alleging a violation of the peremptory norm against torture. Judge Irving Kaufman wrote for a unanimous panel. Judge Kaufman, probably best known at the time and maybe still for having presided over the death case of the Rosenbergs, held that international law was federal law, following or relying in part on a then and still famous case, Pacatabana, decided by the Supreme Court in 1900. He held that that international law was federal law both in the jurisdiction-conferring sense, that is to say, under Article 3, it is federal law such that a case brought pursuant to international law is a case arising under federal law, and also in the supremacy clause sense. It's simply federal law. Falardica touched off a series of cases in the federal courts in which international law of human rights was used under the Alien Tort Statute to enforce human rights guarantees of international law. It was not without its difficulties. 4 years after Falardica, in a case called Tel Orin versus Libyan Arab Republic, Judge Edwards, writing for himself, complained that the law was unclear. He wrote that the ATS is, quote, an area of law that cries out for clarification by the Supreme Court. And now, after 24 years, in 2004, we finally have a decision that, to some extent, clarifies. But there's an intermediate step to the story. After an uninterrupted string of federal court cases in which it was assumed, as Judge Kaufman had written for the Second Circuit in Falardica, that international law was federal law in the jurisdiction-conferring and supremacy clause sense, two professors from this law school, Professors Bradley and Goldsmith, wrote an important article published in 1997 in the Harvard Law Review contesting this conclusion. They wrote, correctly, in my view, as a matter of history, that at the time the statute was passed, it was inconceivable that it would have been thought of to have been federal law. At the time, it was merely general law. And to read that statute as authorizing suits based upon federal law is a profoundly anachronistic reading. This raised quite a fuss in the academy because, if I can say it this way, the international human rights establishment had managed to write into the restatement as well as into the federal appellate court decisions across the country the notion of Falardica. Now, you can be right as to the history and wrong as to the modern law. But I want to be clear that as to the history, Bradley and Goldsmith had it right. This leads us to the case of Sosa versus Alvarez Machin. The case is simple enough. A DEA agent Mexican citizen working in Mexico was tortured to death in Mexico. The DEA tried to get the Mexican government to cooperate in bringing Alvarez Machain to the United States for trial. Alvarez Machain was, still is, a Mexican doctor, and he was suspected by the American government of having participated in the torture by keeping him alive during the torture process so that information could be extracted from him. The Mexican government was unwilling to cooperate in turning over Dr. Alvarez Machain to the United States authorities. The DEA then hired a group of Mexican nationals to abduct him from his home in Mexico, which they did. They held him against his will in a motel in Mexico overnight, flew him by private plane across the border to El Paso, Texas, where they handed him over to federal officials. He was then indicted and was tried in federal district court in Los Angeles. The evidence against him was so weak that the federal district judge, no bleeding heart, this particular judge, I'll just tell you, dismissed at the close of the government's case for lack of evidence. Alvarez Machain then brought suit in federal district court under the Alien Tort Statute, alleging that there had been a violation of the law of nations and that he should be allowed to recover. The United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit took this case en banc and held in a divided decision, number one, quite uncontested, that there was federal question jurisdiction because this was a suit for a violation of international law. And number two, the norm against abduction and involuntary detention was so strong as to constitute an enforceable norm under the Alien Tort Statute. The Supreme Court granted cert. Well, we all know what happens or what it means when the Supreme Court grants cert, particularly just to a decision by the Ninth Circuit. Well, I just slipped that in. But, you know, our reversal rate is no worse than the Fourth Circuit's. They rarely grant cert to pat you on the back. The reversal rate of all the circuits over the years tends to be somewhere between 75 and 80%. So any cert grant, if you're going to bet what's going to happen, the safe bet is a reversal, and sure enough, that's what we got. The United States government had accepted lock, stock, and barrel the Bradley Goldsmith thesis and argued that there was no jurisdiction under the Alien Tort Statute for enforcement of any international law standards, however well established, so that there was no, under this theory, no jurisdiction under the Alien Tort Statute for torture, for slavery, for piracy, for anything on a fairly standard list of Jus-Kogan's violations. The government also argued that even if there were jurisdiction, that the norm of international law was not sufficiently well established in this case to provide a cause of action. Thus teed up, the United States Supreme Court decided a question which, after 1980, had thought by many people to have been decided, but particularly after the publication of the Bradley Goldsmith article had been thrown into question, the Supreme Court says no to the Bradley Goldsmith thesis. The Supreme Court says international law is federal law, at least in some narrow circumstances, in both the jurisdiction conferring arising under sense and in the supremacy clause sense. However, this customary international law, that is to say non-treaty based, if we're a treaty, that's easy because federal treaties come in under the arising under clause. But this customary international law that's sufficient to provide a cause of action under the Alien Tort Statute is a very narrow category of law. Let me read to you a couple of passages out of Justice Souter's opinion for the majority of the court. Before I do so, let me note preliminarily, however, interestingly, Justice Souter gives you very little of this background. He doesn't even tell you that there's a jurisdictional difficulty because this is an alien-alien suit. Notice, this is a jurisdictionally difficult suit because Alvarez Machain is a Mexican and he's suing Sosa, one of his abductors, who is a Mexican. So the only, and he's not suing based on a treaty. He's only suing under customary international law. So the only conceivable basis for jurisdiction under the Alien Tort Statute is that this is a federal question or is arguably a federal question. Justice Souter doesn't tell you this. He just goes to the question as to whether or not customary international law under the Alien Tort Statute is or can be federal common law. The implication of his answer, when he says yes, it can be, is of course that therefore jurisdiction is proper under the arising under clause, but he doesn't say it. Further, the implication is that this federal common law is like other federal common law, supremacy clause law. That is to say, inconsistent state law must give way in face of the federal common law. Now, let me read to you several passages from Justice Souter's opinion so you can understand the narrowness of his decision, or rather, the narrowness of the category of customary law, international law, that can constitute federal common law of international human rights. He points to three specific offenses that at the time, that is to say at the time of enactment of the statute, were held by written by Blackstone to have constituted a violation of the law of nations. Quote, violations of safe conducts, infringement of the rights of ambassadors, and piracy. Period. Those were the three Blackstonian rights that Justice Souter, writing on behalf of the court, concludes those were the only enforceable rights under the Alien Tort Statute at the time that it was written. Now, the evidence that he gives for that is, in my view, rather slender and indeed, I think, inconsistent with his conclusion. The academic community had largely conceded or thought that these three were probably the only things they really had in mind. But then Justice Souter goes on to cite there are two cases and one legal pronouncement of potential relevance here, none of which even hint at such limitations. Let me give you the three cases, or the two cases plus Attorney General opinion, all of them cited by Justice Souter, all of them very familiar in the academic literature. First one is a case called Bolchholz versus Darrell, decided by the District Court of South Carolina in 1795. Captain Bolchholz had captured a Spanish prize. Back in those days, if you weren't a pirate, you could capture a ship, and in many circumstances, the line between pirate and someone entitled to capture was a fairly thin line, and you could then bring the ship in, have it condemned in admiralty and a prize court, and keep much of the proceeds. There were certain exemptions from prize. The standard, a standard exemption under customary international law at the time was property of a neutral held aboard the ship was exempt from condemnation of prize, and that property had to be returned to the proper owner. The owner of slaves held aboard that ship sold the slaves, kept the money. The captain then brings suit against the owner for the proceeds of the sale, arguing that a treaty changed the ordinary rule applicable to the case. And the Supreme Court says jurisdiction is proper under the Alien Tort Statute. Not a hint here of anything about safe conducts and so on, although the cause of action arose under a treaty. Pretty much inconclusive as far as we can tell, as to this point of limitation of safe conducts and so on. Second case, Moxon versus the Fanny. This is a case where a British vessel was seized by a French privateer in American territorial waters. The British owners brought a libel in admiralty, that is to say, seeking to get the ship back. They sought not only to get the ship back, but they also sought damages. The court held that it was without admiralty jurisdiction for a reason too technical to go into, and then it held, although this case is always described as dictum, but it's a clear holding because it's a holding as to why they don't have jurisdiction. The court held, and we do not have jurisdiction under the Alien Tort Statute, because the statute provides that you can bring suit for tort only. for a violation of the law of nations. And this suit is not only for damages, which would be for tort, but it's also for return of the vessel, which is an assumption. So the reason why this is, doesn't fall within the statute has nothing to do with the fact that it's not piracy, that it's not ambassador suit, and that it's not safe conduct. The third is an opinion of the Attorney General Bradford in 1795. American citizens had participated in a raid with the French against a British slave colony in Africa, and this was an opinion of the Attorney General describing what remedies might be available to the British against the Americans. And the Attorney General suggests, even says, that the Alien Tort Statute would be available. Unclear whether it was available because of a treaty, the language is a little opaque, or unclear whether it's available because it's a violation of the law of nations causing financial harm. Now, in a sense, it doesn't matter that Justice Souter might have gotten his history wrong. That is to say, it doesn't matter that the category of cases cognizable under the Alien Tort Statute when it was passed in 1789 was broader than these three little tiny things, safe conducts, ambassadors, and, well, piracy wasn't a little tiny thing, but you're not going to get much of a damage suit against a pirate because they're usually dead. What matters is the lesson that Justice Souter draws from these cases. The lesson he draws is that the norm must be well established and clear. As well established and as clear as the norm against piracy, as the norm against violating safe conduct, and so on. Justice Souter does not say violations of international human rights must be analogous to piracy. He doesn't say that at all. Instead, what he says is they must be established with comparable clarity. So what we're looking at is consensus and clarity rather than analogy. And I'm now just going to read a couple of passages from Souter. The jurisdictional, quote, the jurisdictional grant is best read as having been enacted on the understanding that the common law would provide a cause of action for the modest number of international law violations with a potential for personal liability. Accordingly, we think courts should require any claim based upon the present-day law of nations to rest on the norm of international character accepted by the civilized world, odd, archaic sort of phrase, civilized world, and defined with a specificity comparable to the features of the 18th century paradigms, those that I've just described, that we have recognized. Finally, he writes, whatever the ultimate criteria for accepting a cause of action subject to jurisdiction under 1350, that is to say the Alien Tort Statute, we are persuaded that federal courts should not recognize private claims under federal common law for violations of any international law norm with less definite conduct, content and acceptance among civilized nations than the historical paradigms familiar when 1350 was enacted. Okay, clear enough. Justice Souter, however, does not give us a list of international norms of human rights that would qualify. Justice Breyer, writing a separate concurrence, does give us a list. My guess is that this list would certainly be one that would be accepted by the court in future times, but since it's Breyer writing for himself, in any event would be dictum, doesn't have a whole lot of power, but it's a pretty good prediction. Norms for Justice Breyer would include torture, that is to say, the Philardica case, genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes. I might add as another one that I think is probably suitable for inclusion on that list, but Justice Breyer didn't do so, slavery or involuntary servitude that is tantamount to slavery. But you can see that that's a pretty restricted list of pretty awful and pretty widely condemned behavior. Justice Scalia dissents, joined by Chief Justice Rehnquist and by Justice Thomas. He objects to the entire enterprise. He thinks it entirely illegitimate for federal courts to engage in the enterprise of determining what is customary international law and to pull out of that customary international law a subset that satisfy the criteria that Justice Souter laid out for the majority of the court. Justice Scalia writes, "The notion that a law of nations, redefined to mean the consensus of states on any subject, can be used by a private citizen to control a sovereign's treatment of its own citizens within its own territory is a 20th century invention of internationalist law professors and human rights advocates." He here cites Bradley and Goldsmith for that rather slightly unfriendly characterization of the human rights establishment after World War II. "The framers," I'm reading now coming back to Scalia, "the framers would, I am confident, be appalled at the proposition that, for example, the American people's democratic adoption of the death penalty could be judicially nullified because of the disapproving views of foreigners." Okay, that's Sosa and its prelude. What do we know from Sosa? Here we are 24 years after Philardega, 20 years after Harry Edwards cries out for clarification. How much has been clarified and how much remains unknown? Well, we know a couple of things that maybe we didn't know before. First off, we know, because the Supreme Court has now told us, that there is a federal common law of customary international law enforceable under the Alien Tort Statute. Now, if we were dealing this purely as a matter of history, that's an arguable statement, because at the time of the adoption of the statute, there simply was no federal common law in the sense in which we today use the term federal common law. There was some dispute as to whether or not the general common law could be federal common law. Those who resisted it, I'll cite you another great Virginian, St. George Tucker, Appendix E to his edition of Blackstone, arguing against it. The Supreme Court finally decides against it in 1832 in Wheaton versus Peters. There was no federal common law, although there is today. But to say that there was no federal common law then is not to say that there can be no federal common law today. There clearly is, and there clearly was before Sosa. And neither is it to say that federal common law can't be engrafted onto a statute for which the fit is not perfect. If we were to reject all Supreme Court decisions for which the historical fit is not perfect, we would have a lot fewer cases to read in law school. So while the historical objection is in one sense quite proper, it's not necessarily conclusive as an objection to the creation of modern law. The long and the short of it is, there is a federal common law of customary international law of human rights. The category of this federal common law is, as I've just described, likely to be fairly narrow. Second, we know, not because Justice Souter said it explicitly, but because it is necessarily implicit in what he wrote, that this federal common law of customary international law of human rights is federal law both in the jurisdiction conferring and arising under sense of Article III and in the supremacy clause sense of binding upon federal and state courts alike. He says neither of those two things, but I think both of those two things are necessarily implicit in the decision that he wrote. There, however, remains a great deal that is uncertain. Those two things we know, maybe we thought we knew them already, but now we know them because the Supreme Court has finally told us. First and most obvious of the things we don't know, we don't really know what this list of federal common law international human rights list, we don't really know what's going to be on that list. I gave you my suggestion as to what I think the list is likely to be, based largely on the list provided by Justice Breyer in his concurrence, but that's the subject for future litigation. Second, and much more difficult to determine, what is the preemptive force of this federal common law? Merely to say that the federal common law is supreme is not to tell you in what circumstances it will apply. We have lots of federal statutes that say things, But read the U.S. reports, read the Fed thirds, we have just continuing series of litigations as to what state law might or might not be preempted, either because of direct conflict or field preemption with the federal law. And this preemption question will prove to be enormously complicated and enormously difficult. I'm going to sketch it out, but under the circumstances, not because of shortness of time, but because of lack of foresight, lack of ability to project into the future, my answers will necessarily be quite tentative. Three possible situations in which we might envision the preemption question coming up. The first one is the classic Philardega paradigm case. That is to say, an alien doing a bad thing to another alien in a foreign country. Suit is brought here in the United States because of the happenstance that the defendant had the bad luck or bad judgments to be caught in the United States and be served with process under tag jurisdiction. That's the first one. The Philardega alien sues alien. The second, which may prove to in the future to be a more fertile source of litigation, we're beginning to get a few important cases in this area. Alien brings suit against an American defendant, usually an American corporation, for actions abroad. An example of that case, and I'll give it to you in a little more detail in a moment, is the Unocal litigation that took place in California, where Unocal joined with a French company, Total, and the two of them then joined with the governments of Thailand and Burma, now Myanmar, to drill for oil offshore and then to build a pipeline. There's a fair amount of evidence showing that the Burmese or Myanmar government enslaved some members of its population to help build the pipeline, to build helicopter landing pads and so on to facilitate the building of the pipeline, and that the two private companies, Unocal and Total, the French company, aided and abetting this enslavement. Suit was brought in the Federal District Court in California, came up to the Ninth Circuit, we had an appeal, went en banc, we heard it en banc, we then deferred judgment waiting for the Sosa case to be decided. After Sosa was decided, we asked for supplemental briefing, and then they settled. The case is now gone, so I feel that I'm sort of at liberty to talk about it as if it were just an ordinary case and as though I were not a participant in the litigation, although I did sit on the en banc court, but we did nothing, so I think I can talk about it. That is a second paradigm case. It is not alien versus alien for something that happened abroad. It is rather alien versus American, particularly American company, for something that happened abroad. And the preemption analysis may turn out to be somewhat different. Third category, suit brought in the United States for something that happened in the United States. And I could subdivide this, and for certain purposes it may be relevant. The plaintiff could be an alien in the United States, or it could be an American citizen within the United States. For present purposes, I won't further subdivide it. I'll simply say a category of cases where the event happened in the United States, suit is brought in the United States, and the contention in the lawsuit is that what happened violates a peremptory norm of international human rights. What are the preemption analyses going to look like in this circumstance? I'll go back to the first one, that's sort of the Philardega paradigm case, alien versus alien. In this circumstance, I'm quite sure that state law is preempted in the sense that whatever customary international law, federal common law, human rights law is found is a necessary floor. If suit is brought in state court by a Philardega-type plaintiff, there certainly will be jurisdiction, assuming you can get personal jurisdiction over the defendant. There's no subject matter jurisdiction problem. The state court will be required to obey the federal common law under the supremacy clause. The harder preemption question, that part's easy, the harder preemption question is, should the state court be allowed to give greater force to customary international law than the federal common law does? I don't have an answer to that question. My guess is, but at this point can only be a guess, that if the suit is a classic Falardiga paradigm case, alien versus alien for an event that occurred abroad, that the federal common law will be both a floor and a ceiling, and that a state court finding to the contrary may well be held under the principle established by the Supreme Court in a case called Gering versus Miller in 1968, that state court decisions and state laws cannot unduly interfere with foreign relations activities of the United States government. It's a sort of, if I can call it this, and I'm making up the phrase, an implied, dormant federal relations clause analysis. That is to say, it assumes that the federal government has a sort of overall power over foreign relations, and even in the absence of some particular action that is inconsistent by the federal government, the states will be forbidden to do some things that will interfere with the balance that exists. And my guess is that under this Gering versus Miller line of analysis, this sort of implied dormant foreign relations clause, I say implied because there is no such clause. So not only is the clause implied, but the analysis is of a dormant implied clause. But nonetheless, I think we may have both a floor and a ceiling in that category of case. What about the second category of case? The second category of case is much more complex, because it will very often be that the American corporation will be a corporation with its principal place of business where the suit is brought. Let's imagine, for example, I mean, there are various subcategories of this category, but let's imagine, for example, that the suit is brought in state court. And let's imagine it's a UNICAL sort of case. Suit is brought in California state court, as indeed there was a parallel state court litigation in the UNICAL case. UNICAL is a California corporation. Well, I think the state of California has a fair amount of interest in regulating the behavior of corporations incorporated within that state. And even though UNICAL may or may not have violated the federal common law of customary international law for international human rights, I'm not sure that at this point the category that Justice Souter lays out for us is necessarily exhaustive as to the controls that California may impose upon its own corporation based upon what California thinks international law commands. That's a much different and I think much harder question. And if you can stand it, I'll subdivide the question once more with a bit of historical analysis. And here's at the point where there's a great deal of academic debate as we go forward. How are we to think of international law that is not federal common law? Because there's lots and lots of customary international law that is not federal common law under the SOSA test. Is it either federal law or state law? Does that exhaust the universal categories? Or can we stay in the old, I'm sorry if this is too sort of abbreviated and technical, can we stay in the old pre-Erie world, the Swift versus Tyson world, where international law was simply part of the general law? It was neither state law nor federal law. It was international law. Well, if it's international law in this circumstance, where, for example, UNICAL is being sued by Thai citizens or Burmese citizens who've been enslaved with the aiding and abetting of a corporation, maybe California can say, well, I'm not making this into state law. This is just international law. Now, if they incorporate it into state law, and they say some magic words, we incorporate it into state law, it is state law, and then they say, and read Erie, maybe that means a federal court has to follow it. But if they just say, it's international law, we're following international law, we can do as we please, and the federal courts can disagree if they like, well, maybe the federal courts can disagree if they like. What I can say here is that that is an unanswered and terribly complex question. The third category, application of federal, of international human rights law to domestic cases. The only sustained series of cases in which this has been litigated is, no surprise, is death penalty cases in which the defendant tries to argue that international human rights forbids the death penalty either absolutely or in certain circumstances, such as for juveniles that tend to commit the crime, or for retarded or insane people or whatever. The Supreme Court has now pre-permitted those questions as to juveniles and to those who are retarded, having decided both these questions as a matter of federal constitutional law, getting out a little flack as they did so in hinting that they might have read a foreign decision or two. But those questions are off the table. I've done a search. I suspect it's pretty thorough because I had my law clerks do it. If it had just been me, I might have missed a few, but I think they probably found them all. There are a lot of state cases, state capital cases, in which international law is sought as a defense against the death penalty, and they all fail, every one of them. There are a couple of federal cases in which the same defense is offered. They fail, too. Justice Scalia need not be afraid, based upon the current state of jurisprudence, that SOSA is going to lead anytime soon to an invalidation of the death penalty in the various states on the ground of prohibition under international law. Or perhaps I should say it this way, instead of saying Justice Scalia need not be afraid, maybe I should say those whom Justice Scalia seeks to make afraid need not be afraid, because it will not happen. There will be no international norm that the states will be compelled by international law under SOSA to follow to invalidate the death penalties. But in terms of preemption, that's the floor question. There also is no ceiling. If the states of their own volition decide to abolish or to limit the applicability of their death penalties based upon what they view as the commands or persuasive quality of international law, the states are perfectly free to do so. Well, that's enough complication. The only thing I can say that might be slightly discouraging is to say that I think this is only the beginning of the complication. This is a multifarious, difficult, nuanced topic that even the sophisticated writers in the field, and the academic writers in the field are very sophisticated, even they don't fully break it down into all the constituent parts that are necessary for a full understanding, or even for an understanding of what might be out there for future development. I would conclude by saying that the Supreme Court decision in SOSA is about as ambitious as we are likely to get in the sense of clarifying the law in this area. The Supreme Court answered the question directly in front of it. It gave us a conceptual answer to the underlying question posed by Philartica, and if I can say it this way, by Professors Bradley and Goldsmith, and it left an enormous number of questions left unanswered for the future in good common law methodology. If there's another sort of meta procedural lesson here, it is the one that we all know, but we now see it in a different context. It is important that we know and understand our legal history. It is important that we deal honestly with our legal history. But it is also important to realize and to accept as appropriate that the court can say, that was then, and this is now. Thank you very much.